In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Ah, yes. Time to talk movies. We welcome in Alan Adams of The Main Edge. Happy Monday to you, Mr. Adams.
And to you as well, sir. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thank you. How was your weekend?
It was great. Yeah, it was a good one, all things considered. Did Easter a day early with my lovely bride and my mom and my sister. Mom and sister both fully vaccinated, completely in the clear. And so we had a nice, quiet family meal that, you know, almost felt normal.
Nice.
Almost felt normal, and it was really nice. So that was great. I played in a disc golf tournament yesterday, in the blustery winds and whatnot over there at DR Disc Golf. Had a great time there, and am feeling surprisingly spry and limber, all things considered, today. And last but not least, I'm getting jabbed on Wednesday, Rich. So
nice.
You're looking up.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Left a little sum in your mailbox. Did you get that?
I did. I'm so sorry that I missed you.
I got Stella all wound up, and I feel badly about that because I pulled up, and there were no cars in the yard, and I thought, well, I'll just put this in the mailbox. And then Stella was barking, and I thought, well, maybe they're home. And as soon as I rang the doorbell, Stella was like, intruder, intruder.
Well, she's firmly convinced that that anyone who's not her mom or dad steps onto the porch, that person intends to murder us all. And so so she tends to get a little fired up when that happens.
Yeah, but, well, I would not cross that threshold. She was looking. She was tough. She was going to defend the turf.
Yeah, that's why she's that's why she gets paid the big bucks.
Well, and yet I said, we love you, Stella, and she barked at me.
Oh, and she knows that she's loved.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Well, let's talk movies. You've got a few here to discuss. Where do we begin?
Let's start with Concrete Cowboy. It was a movie I didn't know a ton about going into. Netflix original, stars Idris Elba, among others. And it's this really interesting, thing because I've always been fascinated with, subcultures, like these sort of niche interest areas that grow around, that grow around some off the wall sort of, concept or idea and sort of spring up around it, because we live in such a vast and varied place that there's room for all of these sort of seemingly niche interests to develop their own sort of following, and it's always neat when you find out about one of these that you didn't know existed. And that's what this movie did for me, because I was not aware that there is a very strong equestrian presence in inner city Philadelphia.
I did not know that either.
Right? There's this place called the Fletcher Street Stables. And like, these are people, they live in the inner city of Philadelphia, but they have these spaces where they rescue horses and train them. And they're in they're in the middle of the city. And it's like, the sort of urban cowboy kind of situation. And I'd never heard of such a thing. And so to see a movie made about it was just fascinating, particularly a movie that it's based on a young adult novel by a guy named Greg Neary called Ghetto Cowboy. And it even includes some of the supporting roles are actually played by real life members of the sort of stables crew, so like the group on whom the novel was largely based. Just this fascinating, really interesting, and it also happens to be actually a very well crafted sort of fathers and sons coming of age kind of story as well. So it's got all these sort of influences, as well as the sort of progress and gentrification sort of issues that are facing a lot of these sort of places. But so the basic gist is you have a young man by the name of Cole. He's a teenager. He's played by Caleb McLaughlin from Stranger Things. He's a troubled kid. He's living in Detroit with his mom, and he's struggling with school and with the law. And his mom is at her wit's end and finally makes just the most desperate of desperate moves and takes Cole to Philadelphia to spend the summer with his father, a guy named Harp, and that's Idris Elba. Now, Cole has no relationship with his dad. He hasn't seen his dad in years. He doesn't want anything to do with his dad or with Philadelphia, but he doesn't have any choice because he has to, you know, that's what his mom has decided, and that's what he's left to do. But he doesn't quite realize how many surprises wait for him, although he gets a clue when he first makes his way into his dad's house, and there's a horse in the living room. So Harp is one of these people who operate out of Fletcher Street Stables. And we actually get there's a wonderful moment where we get sort of the almost Cliff's Notes version of the story. But basically it boils down to the fact that in Philadelphia, much like every other city, like back at the turn of the century or whatever, like transportation was horse-based. And so there were stables everywhere. And the automobile began to encroach, public transit and stuff like that, the horses sort of started falling by the wayside. But there were people in Philadelphia in particular who were attracted not just to the horses, but to the idea of keeping alive the reality of the American West as opposed to the mythology, that reality being that a large number of ranch hands, cowboys, what have you, were black men. Like that was very much a thing, and it was something that was largely erased from the historical record, from the cultural record. Like, you know, put it this way, Blazing Saddles is probably a lot less funny if they kept to the historical record. Do you know what I mean? It's that sort of thing. So Cole has he's intrigued by this world, and he's sort of drawn into the horses and whatnot. But he's also being pulled to the streets. Like a kid that he knew when he lived there has grown up as well. They call him Smush, played by Jarrell Jerome. And Smush has become a bit of a hustler, and he's looking to score big and make his way up the ladder in various illicit dealings. But while Cole is initially able to sort of compartmentalize those two worlds, he's timed the stables, leads to these friendships and this sense of community, as well as a slow connection to his dad. But his time with Smush is exciting because it's both new and familiar, and so you've got these conflicting impulses that can't coexist forever. Particularly when he has to keep one a secret from the other. And so he's sort of existing in these two worlds, a foot in each, and there's no real way of knowing whether or not they can last. It's fascinating. Like, the idea that this is based on something real, with actual real people sort of on the periphery of the film, it just fascinates me. Like, they really are, in essence, inner-city cowboys. Like, they're training these horses and caring for them and all that, and for me it comes down to the truth is stranger than fiction is a cliche for a reason. Like sometimes the world sort of gifts us with a story that it's just too good to be made up, and so that makes the movie fascinating. And again, we've got like fathers and sons, and telling those stories, like we've been telling stories about fathers and sons since we've been telling stories. So finding a new way to sort of explore that relationship is tough. But it's one of the reasons why this movie is so effective, because it really does use that sort of unique kind of framework in service of bringing a fairly familiar type of story to us. You've got the old new dichotomy and, setting these urban riders against the forces of economic progress that are pushing development. Like there's a sort of a heft of conscience to the movie that otherwise wouldn't be there. And the performances are great. Like, Idris Elba's phenomenal. He's always great. Nice to see Caleb McLaughlin kind of get this kind of grown-up role. Like, a lot of his, Stranger Things cohorts have sort of found those breakout parts and I don't think he had yet, but I think this is a really good indicator that he's heading in that direction. If he keeps doing work like this, he'll get there sooner rather than later. A lot of other great performances. Jarrell Jerome is good. Oh, and Method Man is in this movie. He's a cop of all things, which is hilarious. I gotta say, Rich, he's kind of sneakily become a low key good actor in recent years.
I've like, seen him in a couple actually, of things. He's good.
You know what I mean? It's just one of those things where it's like, he's part of that sort of that whole cohort, like your Ice-T's and Ice Cubes and like these guys who made their way into Hollywood and sort of, learned on the fly and became really, quite good. It's an interesting movie. It's part of the Sun drama, part urban Western, part coming of age tale, with a good healthy helping of Damn the Man, So it's, saddle up, man. It's worth the ride.
All right. A lot of people talking about your thoughts on Godzilla versus Kong.
Full disclosure, you got giant monsters fighting, like I'm in. Like I am who I am, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise. Like, if someone wants to argue that too many of the blockbusters today are spring from sort of blown out franchises and IP cinematic universes, like, I'm not gonna fight you. Like, big budget movie making is a realm of CGI and superheroes. Everything is loud and too big and, all of that. Fair point. Counterpoint. Sometimes you just want to see giant monsters fight. and that's what this movie does. Godzilla vs. Kong, it's the fourth entry in the sort of Warner Brothers self-styled, they're calling it the Monsterverse. There have been two Godzilla movies and one King Kong movie in this sort of iteration. If you're interested in the actual numbers. If you count everything, this would mark the 36th Godzilla movie and the 12th King Kong movie, if you include all iterations of the things. It's directed by Adam Wingard, currently available via HBO Max and in theaters. Actually, seems to be sort of the harbinger of perhaps the return of the cinema. Had a huge, relatively huge box office weekend. I guess over the 5 days, it did almost $50 million at the box office. So that's something to take into consideration. I watched it at home. It's the sort of like lumpy tentpole sequel that really fits nicely into the sort of development of the franchise. Like, it's big and it's convoluted, pretty fun. Although I will argue, maybe just a little stingy with the monster fighting. I could use one more big set piece, but it's an effort to progress the overall universe, even as it gives us the sort of showdown that we've been waiting for. I'm not sure that the expansion's going to prove fruitful. Like, gets a little muddy and tough to follow in spots. And, at a certain point, there's a law of diminishing returns with this sort of thing, but, where I'm at right now, this is what I'm looking for. And again, there's some narrative stuff that doesn't work as well as it might, but the overall payoff, definitely worth it.
All right. And, I'm sorry. No, keep going. Keep going.
Oh, no. I was going to pretend to give you a plot synopsis, but here's the thing, Rich. It doesn't really matter.
Monsters fight.
What any of these people are doing. Like, just, King Kong, they're keeping him in a dome. The super secret government monster tracking organization is watching him. Meanwhile, Godzilla is attacking robot factories for reasons that no one seems clear about. Said robot factory CEO recruits a Hollow Earth scientist to take them to the source of the Titan's power. There's a podcaster in there somewhere. It doesn't, like I said, it doesn't matter. Like, none of what these people do matter. Like, when there's a person on screen, like, you literally don't have to pay attention. Like, you can. And there's a lot of lore and mythology being built up here. And some of that's fun. And I enjoy that kind of stuff. But the reality is, like, as far as, like, following the action, it does not matter. Because, again, like, you get to the point where it's like, oh, okay. Like, the face-off, the final face-off starts. And you're like, oh, okay. But then you check the time. And it's like, oh, man, there's, like, 35 minutes left in this movie. So however you feel about the convoluted nature of the narrative getting to that point, like, the payoff is absolutely worth it if you are, as I am, a fan of giant monsters fighting each other.
All right, and finally, I don't have Hulu, so I don't know anything about this. Tell me about the WeWork documentary.
Okay, so the full title is WeWork, or The Making and Breaking of a $47 Billion Unicorn. Now, I was vaguely familiar with the whole WeWork saga when things all sort of fell apart last year, but I had no idea what the deal was. Now, the term unicorn is thrown around by venture capitalists, and it's basically a unicorn is a company that is worth $1 billion. Like, that's the ultimate pursuit being made by all of these sort of VC hedge fund, you know, wonks. Like, everyone wants to be in on the ground floor of the next Google or Facebook or Uber or what have you. And so what that leads to is an environment, a culture, where talking a good game is more than enough for a very long time. And that's kind of what happened with WeWork. Like, it's written and directed by a guy named Jed Rothstein, and the movie basically depicts the company's sort of rise and fall, like, from its very peak value of $47 billion to almost bankruptcy in just a matter of weeks. And it's this sort of wonderful illustration of a lot of the dangers that come with this world where you're sort of encouraged to invest in these opportunities that, you know, seem too good to be true for a reason. Now, WeWork was one of the biggest financial stories of the 2010s. Like, this rapidly growing company that, like most startups these days, sought to change the world, or a small part of the world, while also making an absolute boatload of money. Like, that was basically the gist of the last decade or so. And this guy, Adam Neumann, he's the guy. He was the WeWork guy. He wanted to redefine the way we work, and hence the name. It was a basic notion. Like, it was built around finding ways to give the sort of millennials and post-millennials who were sort of swarming into the workforce, wanted to give them access to spaces more conducive to the sorts of smaller, more entrepreneurial-driven businesses and business models that they were developing. There's actually this great moment in the movie where a bunch of former WeWork sort of space occupiers rattle off the names of their various companies, their startups, and it's all this weird, like all sorts of, like, weird portmanteaus and, like, buzzwords, and just this wonderful encapsulation of just the sheer volume of these sorts of, you know, throw it at the wall and see what sticks kind of companies. But yeah, the basic gist of WeWork was they were going to do away with conventional office layouts. They were going to, like, rent and redevelop buildings into spaces that more readily match the wants and needs of this new workforce. Like, honestly, like, when you say it like that, it's not a bad idea as far as that goes. But when you put a narcissist in charge, things get out of hand. And that was kind of the deal with Adam Neumann, who unsurprisingly declined to participate in this film. But there's a ton of footage out there that shows us exactly what the guy was about. Like, in a lot of ways, this movie's not just about the rise and fall of the company, but of this guy, this one guy's sort of steady ascent from an admittedly charming kind of wannabe to someone who almost considered themselves, like, they get bordered on the messianic. Like, it was this, what basically started as a real estate company disguised as a tech company turned into a cult disguised as a company. Like, all you got to do is watch the footage of these various, like, sort of WeWork, like, parties, like these campouts that they would throw for employees and participants. And that, just watch these and you get this sense of that sort of weird undercurrent. Like, yeah, you spend the day going to panel discussions and whatnot, but every night you're basically at a rave. And through it all, you have this guy taking the stage with his headset, you know, trying to channel Steve Jobs, throwing out jargon and relying on his charisma to sort of carry the day. And during that stretch, that was more than enough to get people to just line up and throw money at this guy. Like, they were breaking in just massive amounts of investment cash, but still outspending what they were taking in. Like, it was unmitigated, unfocused growth, like growth for the sake of growth in an effort to expand their valuation. And that explosion in value led to some pretty big hitters getting involved, the biggest being the Japanese financial giant SoftBank, which would wind up throwing literal billions with a B, dollars at this company, drawn in by the many promises made by Adam Neumann, promises that ultimately proved beyond his ability to deliver on. It's just this wonderful illustration of how so much of this stuff that we're looking at, this financial, these huge financial situations, it's a house of cards. Like, you know, so much of this value, so much of the value of these companies is just conjured up out of thin air. And, you know, if you have, you know, A, someone who's willing to, you know, to look at the numbers in a certain way, and B, someone who's charming and able to hold a room, like, turns out that's enough to get you billions of dollars of investment, even if ultimately your business model doesn't make a ton of sense. And that was the downfall of WeWork, came when, turns out, when you do an IPO, the SEC has some questions. And when they saw Neumann and company's answers to those questions, well, that was the beginning of the end. Like, just like a really fascinating look into a story that I had heard a little bit about the end, but I had no idea about the beginning. And so watching this journey go through, some wonderful touches, like the idea of using marking the time progression with the valuation of the company at certain times. So we follow the sort of growth of this company as we see it sort of spiral out of control a little bit, both in terms of the business model and in terms of the leadership. Just fascinating. Just a reminder that when all you're pursuing is wealth, like, everything else falls by the wayside, and so much of that pursuit is built on a willingness to believe in a product or a person. And when we allow ourselves to believe those things, a lot of times what you wind up with is snake oil. And one guy who did everybody wrong, donning a golden parachute and bailing out. Like, look, man, most of the time talk's cheap, but apparently in the VC realm, talk can be very expensive.
All right, we'll check it out. There you go, Alan Adams with the word on movies this week on Pass the Popcorn. Thanks, Al. Appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure, man, always.
We'll see you Wednesday.
Yes, you will.
All right, thank you, and my best to Stella. Tell her I'm sorry.
I will give her your regards.
Thank you.